Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 15, 2016, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group courthouse steps telephone conference call on Rothy Development Corporation v. DOD. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, David Barton. More complete bio was provided to you in the notice of the call, so we'll stop here and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Mr. Barton, the floor is yours.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here today, and I have my law clerk who did a heavy amount of work on the briefs as we prepared them over the last 17 years, starting with the first Rothy cases that went after a different statute than the 8A program. And he's going to say a few words about what took place at the oral argument, which took place last week. And it was pretty good. It was a good exchange with the judges. They started off from a very interesting area that Brian's going to discuss. What I want to do is get right into the statement of facts and the heavy lifting. I'm not going to say anything about myself. I assume there was enough information in what Will sent out from Federal Society, so I'll go with that. I want to go through the statement of facts that carried this case, first of all, and so many of the words are really loaded that you have to listen very closely. But as we started it off in our brief, Section 8A's racial classification has never been reauthorized since 1978. And if you want to put it together with what was probably the first solid attempt at a program for minority businesses, 1968 was the emotional starting time of a statute that was a precursor to the 8A program. And for those of you out there who are younger than a couple of the judges that we had and myself and happened to be in college back in 68, and that was the time of the riots and Chicago presidential convention and all of that kind of stuff, so there was a driving force at that time. In 1978, it was just Congress making a choice that they wanted to do a little bit more and authorize the Section 8A program, which defines socially disadvantaged individuals as those who have been subjected to racial or ethnic prejudice or cultural bias because of their identity as a member of a group without regard to their individual qualities. And that's in 15 U.S.C. 637A5. And that was one of the things that the judges were very interested in at the start of the oral argument. The statute also contains an additional racial classification in a presumption that all individuals who are members of certain racial groups are socially disadvantaged. And that's in 15 U.S.C. 631F1. Finally, under the statute, benefits flow from the status conferred by the definition and presumption through a statutory duty and goal to award a certain percentage of prime and subcontracts to socially disadvantaged small business concerns via competition restricted to those concerns. And again, that's in 637, A1, A through C, A1D, and restricted. And those are different things that apply in each of those. But what you have is the definition, the presumption, and the goals are what the case is challenging. And the court went after that point to a significant degree, trying to get their head around, I think, that it took all three of those, that they all three were provided for in the statute, and reiterated in greater detail in the regulation and in the matter of implementation, which raised the non-delegation issue, which was the second half of the case. The definition, the presumption, and the goal taken together provide Section 8A's racial classification, which is set out in the brief, if you can get the briefs online. The racial classification denies Rothy equal protection under the U.S. Constitution. Section 8A's racial classification purports to authorize the executive to classify members of groups. And the key words there, 8A's racial classification purports to authorize the executive, not Congress, not the courts, not anything else. And of course, the courts shouldn't be the ones acting in a legislative capacity either. But further, Congress purported to authorize the inclusion of unspecified other minorities designated by the Small Business Administration, which is an unconstitutional designation also. And they did take advantage of that in 1982 by naming subcontinent Asian Americans with little or no support, especially statistical support, that they in fact did fit within the definition, presumption, and goal. Section 8A's racial classification applies whenever the SBA deems it necessary, and it's also necessary and appropriate. So in other words, SBA is the one that's in charge of this program under this unconstitutional delegation of authority. And the government argued that there was significant guidance in the statute, and there is a lot of guidance in the statute, but it doesn't have the relevance as to the award of the addressing presumption, the goal, and the definition to a degree that it's a congressional program. It's essentially an SBA program now, which is unconstitutional. Congress has never defined in Section 8A's racial classification or elsewhere how and when alleged barriers to market entry for minority businesses will be remedied by Section 8A's racial classification, or the point at which minority business ownership in the economy as a whole will be remedied by Section 8A's racial classification. There is no statistical evidence in any legislative document submitted to Congress within the past 10 years that identifies or shows where and to what degree an alleged barrier to market entry for minority firms has been eliminated or lessened on account of Section 8A's racial classification. Now I'm going to skip over to, just because of time, to the manner in which I presented this to the court and the four most salient issues in the case for a decision for Rothy. And it's been kind of a frustrating case over the years, because when they have absolutely no statistics to support it, they have improper purposes with racial classification. Rather, they don't even purport to be, Congress didn't even purport to be correcting discrimination. What they were after was increase the number of minority businesses and racially balance in the economy instead. But that improper purpose for racial classification, which is that it is for increasing the number of businesses, racial balancing of the economy instead of remedying discrimination connected to federal contracting. 8A is only and solely a tool to help minorities develop their business, as argued in our briefs. This is the fundamental, foundational flaw in the statute, and it's something that the government's been arguing since the last Rothy case against the other statute, and all the time here. They say it's a business development program. I don't even think understanding that that's part of the reason that it's unconstitutional, because it doesn't identify it as a discriminatory tool. Institutional memory, in other words, Congress and their memory from one authorization to another, is unhelpful in continuing the program from 78 until today. Congress has to have a quantitative and qualitative support prior to enactment. And the quantitative support are the statistics, and the qualitative support is what those statistics show. Furthermore, the racial classification is not connected to discrimination of any kind, as is required by Wygant and Croson and Adirond and Fisher and so many of the other cases that have similar but not exactly the same analysis as this statute does. Connection by inference, which the government uses the words inference over and over again in their briefs, connection by inference or hope, as stated by Congress when they implemented this and when they delegated authority to SBA to run the program, one of the things they say in the statute is, we hope they will do it right. Or maybe it was hearings. But either way, they were just hoping upon hope that SBA would do it correctly without giving them adequate guidance on how to do that. And instead of eliminating racial injustice, 8A only establishes an arbitrary level of compensation to counterbalance alleged societal wrongs. And for those of you who deal in this area, even if there is discrimination identified with some specificity, societal discrimination is not the kind of thing that can support their program, because it doesn't allow a connection between the statistics and whatever program they develop. Croson says the court has never approved of extrapolation of discrimination in one jurisdiction from the experience in another, and that is what this case has. And what that really means in the context of this case is all the government has are statistical studies from state and local contracting, which have no connection with federal government contracting specifically, either in industries or by individuals or whatever. Post-enactment evidence doesn't save them because it's improper to listen to it or pay attention to it. And Shelby, which was it 15 or 2015, Brian? 13. But just within the last 2 years, and interestingly, that was a case that came out of the D.C. Circuit, and one of the judges who was most active in the questioning in the oral argument was in the majority in that decision. So it was kind of fun. We had a little fun between him and me, just that it's an issue that has to be argued. But anyway, Shelby said at the Supreme Court, we cannot pretend, and this has to do with post-enactment evidence, we cannot pretend that we are reviewing an updated statute or try our hand at updating the statute ourselves, meaning the court, based on a new record compiled by Congress since the time of reauthorization. And interestingly, the other program, which was a statute that was commonly called the 1207 program, Congress continually reauthorized it after we first filed suit in 1998. I think they reauthorized it two different times, and then when we went to court for the third time and back up to the circuit, they had not reauthorized it, so we felt like we were really in solid position that time, because most of the statistics at that point that they did have, which we would have argued weren't relevant anyway, were stale, and it was easy to get those out of there. Congress has had plenty of chances, but must be hoping the court will make the hard choices, which the D.C. Circuit did make the choice of how they thought it should be legislated when they made their decision in the Shelby case. The relevant issue here is there was a quantitative evidence to support enactment, but there was not. Without that, there was no strong basis and evidence to support any interest, much less a compelling one. There can be no remedial goal here because there is no benchmark, in other words, a benchmark standard of statistics to measure against, and that way the program can go on forever and they never know whether they're making any progress, and that essentially is what the 8A program is right now. By the numbers they use, the numbers have stayed practically the same, and that's because there was nothing to guide Congress at the time. The next issue is causality, and there are no benchmarks, that is, no mechanism, the benchmarks being the statistics, whenever I say benchmarks, but the anecdotal evidence could also fall into a benchmark status, but the benchmarks that we're really talking about are the statistics. And that is, there's no mechanism to connect the racial classification to the data or determine who, where, or for how long it should apply. There is no connection between the data here and federal contracting, no connection between the goals and the data, and no mechanism to, hang on just a second, lost my place here. Oh, okay. I was looking at the time mainly. There is no connection between the data here and federal contracting, no connection between the goals and the data, and no mechanism to address the goal, adjust the goals over a period of time. What we have is all data preceding the most recent decade is stale. Even if it could be used, there's no evidence of direct discrimination by the defendants, in other words, DOD, no evidence of passive participation, and Congress never even made a note of passive participation. The government, throughout its brief, used words like potentially, consistent with, goal of economic development, inferences, general difficulty, and these are their terminology, general difficulties faced as the court and government repeat over and over again. And none of those terms are strict scrutiny type terms, because Fisher most recently says there has to be a direct, and Croson and Adoran do also, there has to be a direct and exacting connection between the numbers and the ultimate program. I'll let Brian take over here. I've got a few more. All I've got are more detailed statements by, for example, Judge Kennedy, who says, without a reasoned and deliberate examination of the facts and alternatives, the legislation may be misdirected and fail to assist those most deserving of aid, may assist those who are able to operate without such preferences, may harm others unjustifiably, and may operate even under the best of circumstances longer than necessary. So what you have is just a complete discombobulation between no numbers and how long the program is going to go on for. And Brian's going to talk a little bit about one topic, and then I'll let him close out real quick on the non-delegation issue.
All right. Thanks, David. Some of you may have listened to the oral argument at the D.C. Circuit and heard this issue, which was the first question asked by Judge Griffith and Judge Pillard to both parties. The question is whether the 8A statute contains a racial classification, or whether the racial classification is only in the regulations promulgated by the Small Business Administration. That question is controlled by a 1997 D.C. Circuit decision in DynAtlantic, which held over a dissent to the contrary that DynAtlantic had standing to bring a facial challenge to the statute. It's also controlled by the 1998 D.C. Circuit rehearing decision in Lutheran Church versus FCC, which held an express statement of race is not required for there to be a racial classification. Rather, if the text purports to authorize or encourage the use of race, that's enough for a racial classification to exist. The D.C. Circuit followed a 1987 Ninth Circuit decision, Monterey Mechanical versus Wilson, to reach that result. Here, the text of the definition of socially disadvantaged, which David read, the statutory goals to set aside a certain percentage of contracts, and the express identification of races and the presumption of social disadvantage all function together to encourage the use of race. At oral argument, the government conceded in this case that the text of the statute here encourages the use of race and thus functions as a racial classification. And it was proper for the government to concede that under DynAtlantic and Lutheran Church, as they are the law. But it's also the expressed intent of Congress in the legislative history, which you hate to use, but here Congress flat out said that the sole purpose of the statute is to develop additional minority businesses. Some of the questioning at the oral argument, however, proceeded from the standpoint of the dissent in DynAtlantic, which is not the law, which would posit that Section 8A does not contain a racial classification. This was obviously intended sort of to be sort of a devil's advocate sort of questioning to push the parties into sharpening their positions on this issue. Even though the majority opinion in DynAtlantic and the rehearing opinion in Lutheran Church control, it's worth thinking about the practicalities of what it would mean if Section 8A did not or were held not to contain a racial classification, and if the racial classification instead were only in the regulations that the Small Business Administration has adopted. First, we'd have a set of regulations conferring an express racial presumption that were never authorized by Congress. As DynAtlantic showed, a contractor can typically only challenge those regulations on an as-applied basis when attempting to bid on a specific solicitation, which is now a lawsuit that has to go through the Court of Federal Claims. Limitations has run as far as the adoption of the regulations themselves goes. The regulations that SBA put out setting forth the presumption of races that are socially disadvantaged were put out in the 80s. Under longstanding D.C. Circuit case law, after a statute of limitations period has run, a party who seeks judicial review of regulations has to petition the agency for amendment or rescission of the regulations and then appeal the agency's decision. So we would have to petition to rescind something that the SBA was never authorized to adopt in the first place and which we have already argued in this case cannot even be delegated to SBA. In our view, one of the major reasons why DynAtlantic was allowed to amend its complaint in 1997 to add a facial challenge to the statute was for that very reason. We don't have to petition the agency. The 8A statute is a racial classification. SBA's regulations are just parroting the racial classification in the statute, and to the extent they go further, they're subject to a delegation challenge that we have asserted in this case. Judge Pillard also asked whether under Grutter v. Bollinger, the University of Michigan affirmative action case, the legislative body could essentially authorize, through general enabling language, the executive branch to decide whether and when to use race and leave it to the executive to comply with strict scrutiny, as when, for instance, enacting the regulations here. The reason the executive can't do that is the distinction in the alleged compelling interest. A forward-looking diversity interest in Grutter versus remedying past discrimination here. Personally, I think plaintiffs in admissions cases should challenge the lack of legislative authorization for universities to use race because it's not something that can be delegated. There's no freestanding executive power to racially classify. We should have learned something from the Enabling Acts and the Executive Order 9066s of history. But in any case, diversity is a forward-looking interest, and even though finally after Fisher, the program must be tailored at the time of adoption for a diversity interest, there's no need in the diversity context to establish a benchmark prior to and in order to authorize the use of race, as there is in the remedial context here. For diversity, all that matters is the future target, whereas in the remedial context, the legislature has to identify the violation and set the benchmark at the time it enacts the remedy. I think for those reasons, we're confident that there is a racial classification in the statute here, that the court will follow DynAtlantic and Lutheran Church, its own precedents. But it's worth thinking about how things would be different if the SBA could just simply promulgate a racial classification out of whole cloth. I'll hand it back to Will now, and then I guess we'll go into further detail as we go on.
Was that enough to swallow in one big gulp?
Oh, that was great. We'll see if our audience has any questions now. We're going to open the floor to question and answer. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say, the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, if you want to request the floor, please hit star and then pound. Our lines are wide open right now. If you guys want to go back and forth a little bit more while we wait to see if anyone buzzes in with a question, that'd be great, or I'm happy to ask the first question. Do you have anything that you didn't fit in the opening remarks there?
A little bit. I'll kind of defer for a few seconds here to see if anybody jumps in. One of the things that we didn't go into, and one of the most important things, well, I did mention it, just didn't go into any detail, but It was something the court seemed to be extremely interested in, and that is Dynalantic. In the Dynalantic case that our judge deferred to for her decision, said that there was a temporal limit to the 8A program because somebody could only stay in the program for 9 years. Well, that person's just going to be replaced by somebody else who's going to continue to place a burden on my client who would like to bid on contracts. So that doesn't even have any relevance to a temporal length for the statute, which has no sunset provision. It's never been reauthorized since 78. In 88, they did an amendment, but didn't go into anything in any detail that was relevant to the case. So it can just go on forever. And, of course, if they don't have any statistics, they don't have anything to measure it against. The Whitman case is probably our bellwether for the non-delegation. And the biggest thing there is that Congress provided no standards for the scope, extent, or term of the preferences that correspond to any race that the defendants attempt to define, which raises another issue. The contracts are passed out to all races in equal degree, and they don't even have a way to determine which races are getting fewer contracts in which industries, and they just don't know what's going on, is what it really boils down to, in any way that's relevant to a statute that they're trying to discriminate one American against another. That resulted in SBA's designation, as I said previously, of the subcontinent Asian Americans edition in 1982, which has never been in compliance with Croson or Adoran. The delegation requires no findings by SBA based upon a reasoned and deliberate designation, and there is no record here that SBA has ever done so for that designation. The only thing acting as a standard is that Congress directed SBA to do the 8A contracting when use of cultural bias test, as noted in our brief and other places, that fact was uncontested by the defendants, as were most of these facts, and as was admitted to some degree by government counsel in the oral argument, that if certain issues didn't have any support, would it be unconstitutional? And the answer was yes, it would be.
Well, we've got a bunch of people on the line here and still no questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please hit star and then pound, and I'll put you on right away. Oh, and here we have our first question. We got two questions on the line, actually. We'll answer them in the order that they were received. If you'd like to queue up again, please hit star and then pound.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter, and I have the same question I always have in these race-based cases. Has the court shed any light on how we actually define race? Suppose my grandmother is from Scotland, and my grandfather is from Kenya, and my other grandmother is from Poland, and my other grandfather is from Southeast Asia, mixed Thai, Chinese, Korean, and Indonesian origin. What am I?
That issue was addressed directly in the oral argument, and the biggest problem is, as we said in our brief, that hopefully we will never come to the point where we will describe what races are and who is entitled or whatever, because then you go back to a Korematsu kind of thing in the Second World War of picking people who are going to be discriminated against for their race when really there's not hard evidence whether you're a Native American, like you say, you're Polish, Irish, whatever. So the way I left it with the court, and they seem to be in agreement with that, is that we really don't ever want to, it's a hard question to answer because we never want to get into that position where we're talking about it in those terms, where we're going to discriminate one citizen against another.
But in fact, that's what we do, and without determining that, don't we have a meaningless and arbitrary statute?
This is Brian answering your question. I would point you to the Justice Kennedy's opinion in the Hewitt versus by any means necessary case. This was the case involving the constitutional amendment in Michigan that made things, I believe, race neutral there. And the issue was whether Michigan could pass such an amendment. And in the process of analyzing that issue, Justice Kennedy put language into the Hewitt opinion that said basically the judiciary has no standards whether to, as far as adjudging, how to adjudge the creation of or the establishment of a racial group. And I think that becomes a ever-increasing problem as the society becomes more heterogeneous.
Well, we do have one more question on the line. We'll go to that question now. If you'd like to ask a question after that, please hit star and then the pound key at any time. We'll go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Chris Bowen from the DC chapter. Two questions. One, what was your general sense of whether the panel was going your way or not? And second, if an appeal is taken either by us or by the government, how do you think the recent death of Antonin Scalia will affect our chances?
I'd feel a whole lot better if Scalia was still on the court is the biggest answer. The other, I don't think there's any predicting. The judges were very receptive to my argument, and I felt like we were going to at least get a fair hearing off of it, which is not what we get at the district court in this case, nor did we ever get it at the district court in the prior Rothy case. What would the outcome be if we go to the Supreme Court? Without Scalia there, it's obviously more up in the air, even with him there. But it'll be interesting. No real answer on that. Brian's got an opinion, I think.
I would just point out that if you listen to the oral argument, especially the questioning of the government counsel by the court, some of the panel members are practically apoplectic that the government is not arguing former Chief Judge Edwards' dissent in the 1997 Dine-Atlantic opinion, which is, of course, as I outlined, it's the dissent that says that Section 8A does not contain a racial classification, therefore there's no standing. They could not understand why the government was not making that argument anymore, and certainly an outside possibility is that even if Rothy were to prevail in this with this panel, that argument could come back in an en banc petition situation if the government were so inclined. Perhaps the government really believes what it said to the panel, which is that it is under current D.C. Circuit precedent, Section 8A does contain a racial classification because it authorizes or encourages the use of race. But, you know, that those types of positions, especially when you get into the SG's office, always seem to be subject to change. So with a 7-4 quote-unquote party majority on the D.C. Circuit, this certainly is something that's on our radar screen for the en banc, which is why we're sort of concerned about looking at what are the practicalities, what would it look like if a party was restricted to challenging the regulations by SBA instead of challenging the statute, when those very regulations, we argue in this case already, really can't be delegated to SBA to create in the first place.
And the government admits that it's a racial classification that can be challenged, although that doesn't mean anything. The court will act the way the court's going to act. And when you all of the requirements are in the statute. You know, the presumption is in there, the goal is in there, and the definition is in there in different ways. And interestingly, Judge Pillard read all of 637A5, yeah, read through that whole thing, and all of those are in A5 and emphasized in F1 and further emphasized in by reference in that, I can't remember the number right now, maybe 636 something, but all of that is in the statute, so there's not any issue. The issue that was raised in that dissent is just wrong if you read it in context. And interestingly, in a 2012 Congressional Research Service, and these people have been very helpful over the years because they write on this topic a lot, but they admit that the presumption is all there in the statute also. So that's kind of an independent body that's telling Congress, look, you need to, if you're going to change this, you need to get to it and reauthorize it in a manner, because you're identifying all this right now, but you know, you aren't justifying.
Thank you.
Well, we don't have any more questions on the line right now. If you'd like to ask a question, please hit star and the pound key, and we'll get you on right away. While we wait to see if anyone wants to buzz in with another question, I want to make a quick programming announcement. This Thursday, the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit is going to hear oral arguments in the state of Tennessee, the FCC. On Friday at 2 p.m., we're going to have a teleforum discussing those oral arguments. The case has to do with municipal governments providing broadband services. We do have one more question here, and we'll go to that caller now. If you'd like to join after this caller, please hit star and the pound key.
Yes, I apologize in advance if this was already answered, but I was curious who was on the panel besides Judge Pillard.
Judge Pillard, Judge Griffith, and Judge Henderson. Henderson and Griffith are both Bush appointees by the two different Bushes, one by one by the other. And Pillard was appointed just last summer, wasn't it, Brian?
A little bit more than a year ago.
And how scrutinizing was Griffith in that? Because he was pretty searching, even with respect to the prior Obamacare. I believe he was on the King v. Burwell panel as well, and he was by far someone who wasn't considered a foregone conclusion, but was rather exacting in his scrutiny, and nevertheless came out on the side that I would have favored. But I was curious how he had approached this one as well. Was he pretty active from the bench?
He was extremely active, and his questions were very good. And just by looking at past decisions that he's had, it's clear that he's looking at it as a Scalia or somebody like that would look at it, in putting it in the true constitutional context and wanting to get it in the judicial context and not in the legislative, where they would say, well, it looks to me like there's enough there, and identify a couple or three things where the court would actually be taking the place of SBA at that point, because Congress has just left it so open. But no, his questions and his engagement were excellent, as was Judge Pillard's. And Judge Henderson, I guess, could call her the referee for saving me if I ever did anything wrong. Both Pillard and Griffith were extremely engaged.
Who was then, when I believe the other caller had indicated that the panel was apoplectic with regard to the standing issue, I would have expected that perhaps from Pillard, but no one else on that. Maybe Griffith, but where did that really come into play then?
I think it was, for purposes of argument, devil's advocate. That was Brian that said that, and I think he followed it up with, it was a devil's advocate kind of question, so that they could clear the board on that 98 Dianalantic dissent as just being flat wrong, and I hope that we answered it completely. I continued to refer back to the fact that it was contained both in the statute and the regulation, but and that is the presumption, the goal, and the definition were all in there. I didn't have the exact language in front of me, but Pillard had just read it, and you have to be thinking in a different way when you're reading it, because it doesn't start off with, hey, here's the presumption in this thing, and it is. Hey, here's the definition in this thing, and here, and this is it, that kind of thing. You've got the language is clearly there to support it, and I think that point got across in the way that I just reiterated a couple of times to the questions they put in there that, you know, presumption, definition, goal, presumption, definition, goal, and they're all in the statute. And yes, they are again in the regulation.
Well, then Judge Edwards' earlier decision then would, I guess, be the aberration then, given that clarity.
As a dissent, yes, but, you know, no matter what it is, it was still a dissent.
Right.
And it's not the law of the circuit.
I think this is Brian again. I think also that if I were a judge and I saw the government coming up on appeal and sort of felt like the government wasn't making all of the arguments that it was ultimately going to make in the case, as an appellate judge, I would want to flush that out, because I would want to know if a different argument was going to be made at a higher level after it left my court.
One of the interesting things, most interesting, and it came up in the government's argument, and had a high interest with me. I can't remember whether I mentioned it or not during my argument, because I was wanting to concentrate on what we had to say and really wasn't interested in saying anything much about what the government had to say, because this is really our case, just laying out that, hey, here it is, and we win on the facts, the uncontested facts in the case. But that is, their argument relied on full of, as did the Native American group that filed an amicus. And I just wondered if they were going to stick with that when they came to oral argument, and she did, and just stayed on full of love. And both Pillard, I think both Pillard and Griffith, and I think both of them more than one time, I know Griffith may have said it three or four times, but he said, full of love is not the law. Full of love is, you know, has been overturned by Croson and Adirond and Fisher and all of the other cases. So it was really bizarre that the basis of their argument was to go back to a case that's clearly been thrown in the trash heap years ago.
That is really encouraging to hear. Thank you so much.
Well, we don't have any more questions on the line now. I want to make a last call here. This is your last chance to hit star and the pound key. We'll put you right on to ask your question. But seeing none, do you guys want to make a brief closing remark here?
I don't think so. I think, you know, we feel like we're in a very good position to win, and we hope we do. So that's about it.
Well, thank you both for joining us and catching us up on the case. And thank you, everyone in the audience, for your great questions and for listening in today. We're sorry about the inconvenience yesterday, and we're glad that you got a chance to learn about this litigation. We hope to hear from you all on Friday at 2 p.m. to talk about the oral arguments in the municipal broadband case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.